item number four, which is the HPA rules. This is a briefing. Randy Thurston, Pat Chapman, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, Commissioners, Director, Deputy Director. This month, we're briefing you on revisions to three sections of the hydraulic code rules. These are mineral prospecting, residential docks, watercraft lifts, and mooring buoys in freshwater areas, and boat ramps and launches in freshwater areas. We're also briefing you on one new section to the proposed section of the rules, and that's marinas and terminals in freshwater areas. Currently, we don't have any rules for these activities. So the proposed language is in your handouts. Since the mineral prospecting section of the rules is about 55 pages long, we included just the new proposed section on mineral prospecting on ocean beaches. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Pat Chapman to talk about mineral prospecting.
Great. Thank you. Good morning, Commissioners. I think at a previous commission meeting, Commissioner Mankin asked for a briefing on some of the history of how we regulate prospecting. So I'm going to do that before I get into a discussion of the proposed rules. So if you bear with me, we'll go through that a bit. So I'm curious how many people have seen the TV shows on Alaska gold mining currently that's pretty popular. I think a lot of people have the impression that that's what we're dealing with here in Washington. That's not the case. We get very little of that type of activity going on. So we're talking more about small-scale activities. And you can see a definition in rule on the screen of how we define those activities. But in Washington, we're typically dealing with hand tools and small motorized equipment. So it can be all the way from a garden trowel and a hand pan, as you see in the bottom left picture, to something as complicated as a 5 1/4 inch suction dredge that's run off a motorized water pump. And they use that to extract gold from minerals. So the purpose of this activity is to extract valuable minerals from sediments that are in or near the stream. And typically those minerals are gold, although they do find some other types of minerals at the same time. The reason that we regulate mineral prospecting is because it qualifies under the definition of a hydraulic project under the hydraulic code, and that definition is work or construction or other work that uses, diverts, obstructs, or changes the natural flow or bed of state waters. So obviously if someone is digging in the stream either with hand tools or equipment, that's affecting the bed or the flow, particularly if they're pumping water. So that's where our regulatory authority comes in. The department's predecessor departments to this department, Department of Game and Wildlife and Fisheries, started regulating hydraulic projects in 1943 when the hydraulic code was passed by the legislature. And until 1980, the departments issued individual permits for prospecting activities. But around 1979, 1980, there was a tremendous spike in the price of gold, if you remember back then, resulting in a really drastic increase in the interest of prospecting in the state. So we were looking at trying to streamline how we issued those permits. And so the department came up with the first gold and fish pamphlet in 1980. And that pamphlet included regulations that prospectors would follow without having to get an individual permit for really two specific project types. One is the use of pans and the other was sluices. And I'll probably mention a number of different equipment types. I can't really get a definition of all those. I can talk to you later if need be. But small operated non-motorized equipment was permitted through the pamphlet. The pamphlet also included descriptions and timing for things like high banking and dredging, but the requirement was still to get individual permits for those. So we still were issuing hundreds and hundreds of permits, individual permits for dredging and high banking. That version of the pamphlet, 1980, was revised a number of times through the years until 1987, I think, was the final edition of that 1980 version of the pamphlet. And that pamphlet from 1987 remained unchanged for 12 years. We did, though, try to streamline how we were processing some things, particularly in the fact that prior to when I came on board in Habitat Program 96, if somebody wanted to dredge in all waters that were open in the state, they had to get individual HPAs for every water. So we had some people that had 400 permits that we would issue, and they're just rubber stamped, essentially. So when I came on board, we combined 10 to 20 waters per HPA. But even then, they were getting dozens and dozens of permits. So that obviously wasn't very workable. About 1997, prospectors became a lot more politically active, and they backed a bill in front of the legislature that year that would have deregulated prospecting altogether. The legislature considered that, but they declined to go that route. But they did require the agency to work with prospectors to develop new rules and publish a mineral or a golden fish pamphlet for this small-scale mineral prospecting activities, and that was limited to what that type of activity was. So we did work with prospectors over about a year-long period to develop new rules. The commission adopted those rules, and we published the pamphlet in 1999. One of the things we did that was different than previous pamphlets was that we went beyond what the legislature required. What the legislature required was no permits other than the pamphlet for pans, sluice boxes, mini rocker boxes, and mini high bankers and other small concentrators. We decided, since we're issuing hundreds of permits for dredging, why not include those in the pamphlet? And so that's what we did, that and high banking. And so we eliminated virtually 95% of the requirement for individual permits at that time. About that same time, I think I've lost my place. 2006. Okay, yeah. So in 2006, prospectors eventually decided that they would like to commission or petition the commission to repeal those rules and adopt a set of rules that they had developed on their own. And the commission decided against that. However, they did direct the department to go through rulemaking again with prospectors and other stakeholders and develop new rules and a new pamphlet. And what followed then was a year and a half long process to develop that. We worked with stakeholders involving federal and other federal and state agencies, tribal representatives, environmental interests, and prospectors to develop the rules. The commission adopted those rules, and those are the rules we're operating now under. The current pamphlet was published in 2009. In the period of time we were working with prospectors and stakeholders to develop the rules, there was a bill that was in front of the legislature that was finally passed that required the department to work with state parks to conduct a two-year pilot program to investigate the feasibility of ongoing beach prospecting on the coastal beaches in the seashore conservation area. And I know there was some discussion in a previous commission meeting about that. So we did conduct that pilot project, and that was completed in 2010. And essentially the findings of that in a report that was produced by both departments was that there really weren't any conflicts with other users of the beach, and provided prospectors followed the rules that were in place for the operations, that there weren't any significant impacts to fish life or habitat that we could identify. So following that, then in 2011, the Parks Commission passed rules of their own that allowed beach prospecting on the seashore conservation area, the lands that they managed on the beach. And following that, then we were able to issue individual permits for beach prospecting for the protection of fish life. And we've issued over 1,000 permits for beach prospecting since then. Let's see, I think I got a little bit ahead of myself. A couple of things that we've allowed in the current Golden Fish pamphlet is a variety of the small-scale activities can occur without even needing the pamphlet on site. In the past, the pamphlet always had to be on site. There was some indication that that was onerous, so we eliminated that possibility. So essentially, it's like somebody goes out fishing, and they don't need to have the fishing pamphlet with them. They just need to know what the rules are and follow them. We also allowed some larger pieces of equipment than we'd allowed in the past on certain waters with certain restrictions. And we updated the science regarding presence and absence of fish and life history aspects and when incubating fish are present. So I want to talk a little bit about the philosophy of how we regulate prospecting. So obviously, the legislature has required us to have a golden fish pamphlet. So we've done that. We've expanded what the requirement of the legislature is, like I said before. We allow, through the pamphlet, high banking and dredging without a regular permit.
Excuse me. Commissioner Holtzmiller, do you have...
What's high banking?
High banking is an activity where the processing machinery stands on the bank itself, out of the water. The aggregate that's being processed is hand-fed into the machinery, and there's a pump that provides water that washes that material as it goes down through a sluice box. As opposed to a dredge sits in the water, the material is fed by suction into the bed. And I have a picture later that I can show you, High Banker. So our philosophy on regulating, so we want to streamline as much as we can through the pamphlet. We do have an obligation to protect fish life, so we have regulations and rules that restrict the type of activity that can occur, the size of equipment, how many people can work, the time of year, so we can protect fish. But we allow as much activity as we can, provided fish life is protected. Now, through the pamphlet, we have timing windows, we have restrictions. Prospectors can apply for exceptions to those restrictions in the pamphlet. And if we can find a location and time period when the activity can happen, then we'll permit that through an individual HPA. And we've issued hundreds of those, I think the last 4 years, 480 permits for exceptions to the pamphlet. Okay, just real briefly about some of the impacts to fish life. Because this is a hydraulic project, there are impacts to fish life. We believe, though, that provided prospectors can follow the rules, the impacts are minimal. But some of the things we're looking at are there are particular life stages that are really vulnerable. Incubating eggs or fry, if they're disturbed, for the most part, will be killed. So we prevent most activities from occurring in water during times when eggs or fry are present. Free-swimming life stages are less vulnerable, and so we do allow in-water work during times when there aren't incubating eggs or fry in the gravel. But they can be impacted by high sediment loads if there's a high concentration of prospectors in one area, or if unfilled pits are left and water levels drop and fish are stranded. So there's some impacts there. Environmental productivity can be reduced if the hydraulic of the stream is changed, if undercut banks occur, or if unfilled pits are left remaining. And lastly, if there's a high concentration of activity in a concentrated area, like in small streams, fish passage can be affected as well. So we limit sizing and spacing of equipment in those regards. So lastly, just a discussion of what proposed changes we have in this rule package. And we really aren't proposing a whole lot. We are looking at a few work window changes based on some new data that we've gotten regarding timing of spawning and presence of fish in particular waters. But the main thing is that we're looking at adopting rules that allow beach prospecting into the pamphlet. So instead of issuing the 1,000 permits for individual permits for prospecting, we'd put it in the pamphlet. Now, there was some discussion, I know, last commission meeting about what area we are regulating. And I know there was some discussion this morning about parks, what parks can do and what we do. So just to clarify, what the Parks Commission manages is the Seashore Conservation Area, which is the coastal beaches all along the coast of Washington that are state-owned lands, and that, if you look here at this diagram, that run from the extreme low tide to the ordinary high tide line. That is the Seashore Conservation Area. It does not include Willapa Bay or Grays Harbor. It's just the outer coastal beaches. In our rules, we're proposing you need the Golden Fish Pamphlet if you're operating in this area. However, in the area that's delimited by the upper limit of ghost shrimp burrows to the ordinary high tide line, you don't need a permit. You can operate in that without having a permit.
Commissioner Smith has a question.
Just a quick question. That's just the coastal beaches. That's not Puget Sound?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Correct. And the Seashore Conservation Area is defined in statute that's administered by the Parks Department. Yeah. And the reason we can't, in the past we weren't able to issue permits for beach prospecting was the Parks Commission did not allow that activity, and therefore they wouldn't do a SEPA determination, and we couldn't then get a complete application to allow us to issue a permit. Now they went through SEPA and we can issue those permits. So now we want to just incorporate that into the pamphlet.
Director Anderson.
Thanks, Pat. So the area between the upper limit of ghost shrimp burrows and the ordinary high, and the subheading there, no HPA required to operate in this area. Am I correctly interpreting that what application of the rules that are in the Golden Fish pamphlet, are they applicable in that area or not?
The way the wording is now, as I read it, says they just don't need a permit, that they would still have to follow the rules when they're doing that activity. They just would need the permit on the job site to do that.
So they,
but we can look at that and see if that was truly the intent.
So they don't need an individual permit for that specific activity, but when they're doing prospecting in that area defined as the upper limit and the ordinary high, they would still need to follow the rules in the Golden Fish Pamphlet.
They would need to follow the rules, but they would not need any permit. They wouldn't need an individual permit,
right,
and they wouldn't have to have the pamphlet with them.
Yeah, gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. So is that, do you think that's clear? I mean, that understanding, is that?
That gets into some of the comments that we've received in these draft rules. I think perhaps it isn't totally clear, which is why we wanted to include this this graphic. That wasn't in the proposal that we've submitted out in the past, so no one has seen this yet. So hopefully that will make it more clear.
Well, it seems to me that if the Golden Fish pamphlet rules apply to the area where between the upper limit and the ordinary high, that we that information ought to also be in this graphic. Mm-hmm. So the understanding that there's no individual HPA permit required, but it doesn't mean you don't have to follow.
Right.
Right.
Right. Okay. No, that's a good point.
Thanks.
So we have gotten some comments on that. Some of the other comments we've gotten, and this is, I think in your packet you have a larger synopsis of comments we've received, but some of the big ones are that some folks would like to see greater restrictions on dredging in waters with anadromous fish. They think there's too big of an impact and we should protect that more. Some would like to see notification of all work prior to work starting, and also notification of the tribes for that so they can know what's going on. Some also would like to see some additional timing restrictions in some waters of the state. On the other side of the fence, as you've heard today and previously from prospectors, many of them don't believe we really have any regulatory authority at all, and so we should just eliminate that. Don't believe we have any authority for beach prospecting requirements because of the Parks Commission requirements. And that finally, there is some confusion about, because we discussed ghost shrimp, that we seem to be regulating for the protection of ghost shrimp. And that's not the goal of why we mentioned ghost shrimp. It's just a line of delineation of where a permit would be required or not. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Randy. Sorry.
Good time. Commissioner Kehoe has a question.
Yeah, I have a question about the regulatory authority of the state. You know, we've It's been a long time since I went to law school, but I do remember studying about this, the mining laws, you know, and how they've been around for a long time, and it's kind of a unique area of the law. But I imagine that somewhere along the line there has been a legal determination about, I don't, you know, Washington or another state's authority to regulate mining activities. Am I correct? Has there been a legal determination, or are you aware? Or maybe I should, we should ask the Attorney General.
Yeah, you probably should ask the Attorney. What I will say is that Mr. Beatty right now has a case in front of the Court of Appeals that we heard on the 4th of February.
Okay.
Regarding just that question, among other questions. So I don't think I should comment specifically on that. But
okay, no, fair enough, yeah, fair enough. Yeah. We'll let the courts weigh in on that. Okay.
Commissioner Mencken.
Why is the upper limit of the ghost shrimp burrows an important landmark?
The one of the problems we have, particularly on ocean beaches, is it's pretty tough to have permanent markers of, not jurisdiction, but of significance. And so what we were attempting to get at is there, most of the activity on the beach for prospecting occurs in that upper area because the gold and black sands are washed up there. So the assumption that there is some point where there's less impact possibility from their activities, and can we deregulate some of that? And so the ghost shrimp line, the assumption was that that's really the upper limit of significant biota, I guess. And if we can determine a line there, because ghost shrimp don't occur everywhere, but if we can determine a line there, then we would allow them to do their activities with less burdensome regulations, if you will.
So this is really kind of an arbitrary line. Is it easy to see? Yeah. Clearly visible to somebody that walks out onto the beach? And then how would you enforce this?
So I'm not a ghost shrimp expert, so I'm a freshwater guy. I have seen photographs. You know, if they're highly concentrated, yes, it's fairly obvious. But again, if they don't occur, or there's very few, or someone can't determine what that line is, then the assumption is you'd better go with what's in the pamphlet. Now, enforcement, then we'd have to have enforcement officers out there, you know, determining is it really obvious that there's ghost shrimp there or not. That may be a little bit of an unanswered question at this point. And if I can get back to Commissioner Holtzmiller's question about sluice box. So this is a sluice box here. So you can see they're shoveling material into what's called the hopper or grizzly. Water is pumped in, runs out here, and the material runs out, and it's collected in the sluice box itself, the gold is. So,
Director Anderson?
Well, just reflecting back on the discussion that I was involved in terms of looking at the line and looking at for some, you know, on a beach that's pretty nondescript in terms of landmarks. Now there are certainly some exceptions where we don't have ghost shrimp present, but along the sandy beaches we generally do. And when you walk out to the beach, you encounter ghost shrimp holes first, and then you begin to, if you're in an area where there's razor clams, then you begin to encounter razor clams. So in looking at the information we had about sand lance spawning areas, so we were, that's a part of this, of trying to look at that issue, is where, how can we define a line above which we have fewer concerns, and the requirements within the Golden Fish pamphlet would be sufficient to address our concerns. What could we use on the beach as a way to have some demarcation of that? There's going to be some officer discretion involved in this, to be sure, if there are. If you're if you're out, if you're, you know, at low tide, if you're way out there toward the edge of the, getting close to the edge of the water, then you're, I mean, you're out too far if you're doing it without a permit. So it was just an effort to try to define a portion of the beach which we would have few restrictions on, to, you know, so that people didn't have to go through the process of getting a permit, and where we had fewer concerns from a conservation perspective of other species that might be impacted.
Okay. Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have really any experience out on the coast with ghost shrimp or razor clams or gold, but in Puget Sound, digging clams, you know, you run into ghost shrimp on a regular basis. And I guess my concern would be defining this line within some reasonable, I mean, so you start digging and you're going to start digging for gold and you got ghost shrimp, so you run up the beach 3 feet and you dig another hole. I just don't know how it works. I mean, I don't know how you monitor it. I don't know how it works for the miners. I don't know how it works for, it's so arbitrary that I can't connect the dots on it.
Sounds like we've heard an explanation that it is not arbitrary. Yes. It's actually defined and logical and justified. So let's let them proceed. Randy?
I'm thinking a field trip to the coast. But So I'm going to switch gears here and totally different set of provisions or rules. And I want to talk about overwater structures. We have two sections in our rules that deal with overwater structures and freshwater areas. And these are residential docks, watercraft lifts and buoys, and marinas and terminals. Now, we currently have rules for residential docks. These rules apply to all docks regardless of the water body that they're in. So what we're proposing in the new rules is to really differentiate the requirements to protect juvenile salmon migrating in shallow nearshore waters in those water bodies where we do have salmon and trout production from lakes that do not. So you'll see two different standards in the residential docks depending on the salmonid use in that water body. The other section on overwater structures is marinas and terminals. Currently, we do not have any rules for freshwater marinas and terminals. We do have a section in saltwater for marinas in saltwater, but it also does not cover terminals. So what we're proposing to do is add these two project types to the rules for freshwater and then also modify the marina section in saltwater to include terminals. So residential overwater structures are docks, watercraft lifts, mooring buoys. Docks come in a lot of different shapes and forms. They can be a pier only, as shown in this picture. They can be a pier with a ramp at the end leading down to a float. They can be a floating dock only, or they can be a ramp that leads down to a floating dock. And oftentimes, docks on lakes in particular have watercraft lifts associated with them or mooring buoys. So marinas are public or private facilities that provide vessel moorage, fuel, or commercial services. Marinas are often constructed of a series of docks. They include covered moorage, as seen in this picture. And a lot of our marinas have boathouses associated with them. Terminals are public or private commercial wharfs. They're intended to be used for storing, handling, transferring, or transporting goods, passengers, or vehicles to and from vessels. And most of our terminals in freshwater are on the Columbia River system. So the reason I put these two sections together is because really the fish concerns or the impact mechanisms from overwater structures are the same regardless of whether they're residential docks or larger facilities. The difference being, of course, that marinas and marine terminals are larger in scale. They're associated with heavier vessel traffic, so they pose a greater risk, but the impact mechanisms themselves are the same. And those impact mechanisms are shading, sound waves, and water quality concerns. Getting ahead of myself here. So shading or light reduction reduces the survival of aquatic plants, and where we have beneficial aquatic plants that provide food or nursery and rearing areas for fishes, this is a concern. Shading also affects the behavior of juvenile salmonids and other fishes that migrate along the shallow water, in the shallow water in the nearshore area. It's been observed that when they come to a dock or an overwater structure that has a very strong contrast between shading and no shading, that they will, instead of going under that structure, they will turn and migrate out into the deeper water. And this increases their risk of predation. So that is something that's been observed in some studies. It doesn't occur, as we discussed last meeting, it isn't observed in all cases, but it is a concern. Docks, especially in lakes where we've got more water species like bass, they're attracted to the piling. They like to hang around the piling, and that can also increase the risk of predation where we're concentrating those ambush predator fish species into an area. Pile driving, impact steel pile driving, since about 2003 has become a concern. Mainly because we've found that impact steel pile driving kills or injures fish. So there's two types of pile driving. Impact is where the hammer drops on top of the pile and it's a bang, bang, bang. And the other method is vibratory driving, which is a more shaking the pile in. Pile driving, again, is there's been a lot of work on it, and it is a concern. Water quality, treated wood. In our current rules, we don't allow oil-based treated wood in lakes. And oil-based treated wood is creosote, or another type is pentachlorophenol. We are proposing actually to ban oil-based treated wood from all water bodies in the state. And so that is a change also. This is in line with our current practice. It's also in line with what the Department of Ecology and Corps currently require. So our new provisions that we're proposing limit nearshore over and in-water coverage, especially in that first 30 feet or so from the shoreline. So we do that by requiring a pier structure, by increasing the height of the structure, reduces the shading impact, decreasing the width of the overwater structure to decrease the shading impact, or requiring grading be installed in the decking to allow light to get through. We have provisions that limit the use of treated wood. So some treated wood is allowed. The non-oil-based treated wood is allowed. So there's provisions on how that should be treated by the manufacturer for use in the aquatic environment and where it can be used. And we also have some provisions that are unique just to terminals and marinas. And those provisions are to encourage new development of those facilities to be done so that dredging is not required. So getting them out in deep water, so it either doesn't require initial dredging or maintenance dredging in the future. And then also we've There is a statute that was passed in 1996 that requires the department to issue 5-year permits for maintenance for marinas and marine terminals, and so rules for those that activity is also proposed. So that we've been doing it, but we've just never had rules for it. The last kind of big area for new provisions is provisions to reduce the pile driving noise impacts. So requiring vibratory pile driving when it's practicable, it can't always be done. But if impact pile driving is necessary, then there's some steps they can take to attenuate the sound so it reduces the risk to fish from being killed and injured by pressure waves, sound pressure waves generated by the pile driving. The last section we have to talk about this morning is boat ramps and launches in freshwater areas. Kind of like overwater structures, boat ramps come in a lot of different forms, and launches come in a lot of different forms. But the definition is here, and they're graded slopes, slabs, planks, rails used for launching boats, and they can be for launching boats from a trailer. We have got launch areas that are just for hand launching canoes. So they're quite diverse. And this is actually a picture of our Lake Sutherland access area with a boat on our boat ramp there. So the major fish life concerns with boat ramps and launches, the first one is obviously when you put a boat ramp on top of natural bed, then there's a loss of that habitat. So a concrete boat ramp or slabs placed on top of that bed displaces the organisms that would have used that habitat. Boat ramps that are constructed above the beach slope, so they're elevated, can block wood and sediment transport, movement of wood downstream. This particular concern in river systems. So the river, the wood and sediment is really important for maintaining downstream habitat. And then also the boarding floats often associated with ramps in particular that ground can also alter juvenile fish migration behavior. This is actually a picture of a rail launch, so it's a lot different than a regular boat launch. So new provisions for this section would be to avoid constructing these in fish spawning areas. And obviously this would be more of a concern for a ramp rather than like the rail launch we just saw in the last picture. Design the structure to minimize interference with wood and sediment transport. And then design boarding floats to minimize grounding. And this is actually a very good picture of a design. I was trying to see if I can get the arrow. The design, designing those boarding floats to minimize impacts. Yeah, they do ground, here, but there's a lot of open area for fish to migrate underneath out here. and this is entirely graded, so it allows light through also. So, so just in terms of comments that we received, we just finished our comment period on our draft programmatic environmental impact statement in the middle of the month, and we're compiling those comments now. We've received 58 letters, and of the 58 letters, we got 3 comments on this section and not a lot of concern. So now, and I did miss this point on my last, on the marinas and terminals and the overwater structure section. We got 9 of the comment letters commented on the overwater structure section. And most of those comments were around the restrictions on size and the grading requirement and the grounding requirement for docks constructed in water bodies where we have juvenile salmon. So that is a concern that's been raised. So February meeting, we're going to spend some time talking to you about the water crossing section, and water crossings are culverts, bridges, and fords. This section in particular has generated a lot of comments, public comments. So Dave Price from our Restoration Division is actually going to come talk about this section. And then we have two new sections that we're proposing, fish passage improvement structures, which includes fish ladders, fish ways, rough and channels, trap and haul, and beaver dam management, which has provisions for beaver dam removal and modification. In general, beaver dams are good for fish, but they have a propensity for putting them in the wrong place sometimes. And actually, these pictures are a very good example of a beaver dam that obviously needs to be removed for public safety and property to prevent property damage. So, and that's all we have today.
Terrific.
Thank you.